Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. That music means it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. We got a whole bunch of weird questions from all around the internet, all around the world for Jimmy Akin today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the weirdness. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where week after week he takes on weird questions in long episodes, not in shorter answers like he will today. So if you want hundreds of episodes of all kinds of mysteries of all different, well, from all around the world and from every different kind of possible mystery, of faith mysteries, of every kind of mystery in the world, aliens, ghosts, and I'm trying to give you a flavor of the thing. I think aliens and ghosts is enough. Jimmy Akin, thank you for being here for some weird questions.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cy Kellett. And speaking of ghosts, those were the subjects of the two most recent episodes of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at the time this program releases. We just wrapped up a two-parter looking at the ghosts reported on the USS Hornet, an aircraft carrier from the World War II era that is reported to have an entire ghost community living aboard with a chain of command and everything. So some really interesting stuff. Yeah.
Nice. All right. And what's the other one? You did two episodes on ghosts?
Two episodes on the USS Hornet.
On the Hornet. Oh, okay. Very good. Check it out at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts. There's a reason it's one of the most popular documentary podcasts out there because each week a new and exciting mystery with Jimmy. All right. Weird questions. They get weird sometimes. So buckle up. We're going to get into the weirdness. This first one is a little bit long. So I have a weird question for Jimmy. Well, that's a promising beginning.
Who's asking this question? Oh,
Landon. I apologize, Landon. Okay. I apologize for that. What happened to Jimmy between episodes 314 and 315? The YouTube video on The Soul of Frankenstein's Monster is an audio-only version with no camera. Ominous, to say the least. In episode 316, we once again see Jimmy, but now he dons a white cowboy hat. There was mention of a move back to the Ozark, and this is where my questions emerge. There is a distinct change in Jimmy's pronunciation of words, especially the words ending in ing. Jimmy now pronounces words with ing with a more redacted in. Was Jimmy abducted? This is a very important question. Are the Borg involved? Has there been an assimilation? Has Jimmy employed AI in his likeness and asked the program to represent him in a more Western fashion? Does the hat have influence over Jimmy's dictation? Is there something in the water in Arkansas? This is a lot. Does Jimmy have an identical twin who has taken over? I mean, no offense by my question, Jimmy. The change in dictation was very noticeable and weighs on my mind when I listen to episodes now. Settle the matter and remove the perplexation. Wow, what a word. God bless and thank you for the entertainment and enlightenment. All right, Landon, thanks.
Okay, so Landon's encountering a couple of things. Now, the first one is the cowboy hat. And I've worn cowboy hats for years. People who know me and would see me, you know, out and about or driving around or things like that have seen me wearing a cowboy hat for, you know, literally decades. And a number of years ago, I started wearing it when I would also give talks. And so, like, when I appear at the Catholic Answers Conference in September, I wear my hat when I give my talk. But I eventually decided, you know, I'm just going to make this part of my standard branding. And so I decided to start wearing a hat when I'm doing live streams and recordings as well. So it's just part of my branding now. When it comes to to my accent, that's something that is because of the move back to the Ozarks. I grew up here in Northwest Arkansas in the Ozarks. It's where I'm from. And so when I moved back to the Ozarks about a year and a half ago, coming up on 2 years at this point, I decided, well, you know, I've been in California for 30 years. I've been suppressing Southern elements in my speech, and I'm going to go back to using and, you know, the kind of accent I grew up around. And so, you know, anytime you have an accent shift, it's a little uneven. And some people, you know, because it takes a little while for the accent to reassert itself or settle in or whatever. And so people noticed quickly that I was so-called dropping my G's, which really amounts to nasalizing the ing suffix. So it becomes in. But there are other elements to the accent too. You'll notice my use of vowels is different. And, you know, I decided to just flip the switch rather than drag out the process and have it be a long drawn out thing. I figured everyone would get used to it quicker if I just did it all at once. And, you know, it takes a little while to settle in, but that's what's going on. No Borg, no AI, no identical twin, no nothing like that.
As a matter of fact, the Borg is quite a distinct accent. You could pick that one up, I think, Landon. I remember Seven of Nine. She still couldn't lose the Borg accent even after years. She still had that Borg accent. All right, this one we got time for this. This one comes from Chaz. If the sun incarnated on multiple alien worlds and ascended to the right hand of the Father from each, would he have more than one body in heaven? If so, would he have multiple thrones?
Okay, so let's notice that Chaz is asking me this question, and so I'm going to answer this question. But a lot of people, when I answer questions, they don't notice that I was asked this. Instead, they say things like, Jimmy Akin is advocating the idea there are multiple Christs on multiple worlds. Okay, Jimmy Akin is not doing any such thing. Jimmy Akin has been asked a question, if there were multiple Christs on multiple worlds, what would the results be? So that's not the same thing as advocating the idea this is real. I don't know that there are intelligent aliens, much less do I know that they're fallen, much less do I know that Jesus is incarnated on these worlds. God might have chosen not to redeem these aliens, or he might have chosen to redeem them in some other way that didn't involve an incarnation of his son. So I'm being asked this question, so I'll answer it. If the sun incarnated on multiple alien worlds and then from these alien worlds ascended to the right hand of the Father from each, would he have more than one body in heaven? Well, presumably, you know, if he incarnated on these worlds, he would have taken on a body. And if he then ascended to the right hand of the Father in heaven, he presumably would have taken that body with him. And so he would presumably have more than one body in heaven. There's nothing that contradicts God's omnipotence in doing that. You know, Thomas Aquinas points out, for example, that it's possible for all three of the persons of the Holy Trinity to incarnate if they chose. And if you can do it once, you can do it more than once. You know, omnipotence is not, the ability to do anything is not limited. And so if you can incarnate once, you can incarnate multiple times under God's omnipotence. So there's no intrinsic problem there from a divine power perspective. If so, the question continues, would he, the Son, have multiple thrones? Well, possibly. However, I would be a little cautious here because, you know, the image of God the Son seated at the right hand of the Father is an image that's based on human customs, where you have like a king seated on his throne, and whoever his right-hand man is seated on another throne at his right hand. But this is based on human customs. And if he had incarnated on other worlds, they might not have thrones at all. They might not even have the ability to sit down. That's something, or they might not sit down the way humans do on chairs. So, even with regard to our Jesus and his sitting on a throne, I don't know that it's a literal throne. I think that this image is meant to convey the idea that Jesus is, you know, is right up there with God as a power in heaven, with God the Father as a power in heaven. And whether there's a literal chair, I don't know, because God doesn't literally have a body, and apart from the incarnation. So God the Father doesn't have a literal body and wouldn't sit in a literal throne. And that raises a question about how literally should we take this image?
All right, Chaz, thank you very much for the question. It's Weird Questions. The weirdness has just started. Lots more to come right after this on Catholic Answers with Jimmy Akin.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1996. The world over debuts with Raymond Arroyo. Each week, Raymond challenges viewers with important political and cultural reporting and analysis of a wide variety of topics of interest to Catholics and people of faith.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Stay all this year. Everybody who joins Society 315 gets a full year of the Halo app when they join. If you'd like to find out more about the Catholic Answers Society 315, just go to casociety315.com, casociety315.com. Next question. Oh, it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And this next weird question comes from Francis. Hello, Mr. Akin and Cy Kellett. My question is, how would you go about baptizing the White Witch from the book The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, set in Narnia? Big fan of the work you do. Also, how would you go about baptizing the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz, given her allergic reaction to water? All right, about big fan of you guys. Keep up the great work. Oh, well, thank you very much, Francis.
Okay, so Jadis, or the White Witch in the Chronicles of Narnia, is not allergic to water. And while she does have the ability to freeze water, like when she froze Narnia so that it was always winter and never Christmas, if she had repented and wanted to be baptized, well, you just say, hey, lay off on the freezing business for a couple of minutes. We got something to do. And then you'd baptize her the normal way. So it wouldn't be a problem. It would be a problem with the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz, because she is allergic to water. You know, at the towards the end of the movie, Dorothy throws a bucket of water at her and she just melts and all of her beautiful wickedness is destroyed. So, well, I guess if she wanted to be baptized, she would have turned her back on her beautiful wickedness. But but we would have an obstacle in terms of how to baptize her. Now, it could turn out, depending on what Frank L. Baum wanted to do, that her allergy to water was a product of her beautiful wickedness, in which case, when she turned her back on it and repented of her beautiful wickedness, she might have lost her allergy to water. So you could baptize her in the normal way, too. But let's suppose that didn't happen. What would you do then? Well, of course, she is able to have baptism of desire. You know, yeah. She's able to be saved in that way. But it's better to baptize her if it's possible so that she doesn't have just baptism of desire, because you need actual baptism in order to access the other sacraments. And so you would want to baptize her if at all possible. How could you do that? Well, if I were in charge of this case, which I'm not, I would do some testing. I would see, you know, what kind of moisture tolerance does she have? Because there is moisture in the air, and she's not melting down to nothing because of that moisture.
Oh,
so
yeah.
She's obviously got some tolerance to moisture. So I would like do some tests. I would get a cloth. I would put a little bit of moisture on it and then touch it to her skin and see what the reaction is and so forth. The ideal would be to use a very limited amount of water, just enough so that it could flow on her skin, and baptize her with, you know, maybe an eyedropper or something, using just enough water so that it could flow on her skin, and baptize her in that way, assuming that prior testing showed she could tolerate that amount of water. Now, it might not be fun for her. It might hurt. It might even damage her skin. But that would be a way in relative safety that you could still try to baptize the Wicked Witch.
Francis, thank you for those important questions. You know, you ever do play that? If I were Pope, Jimmy Akin would be the head of the dicastery for the salvation of fictional witches.
I would. You'd have to create a new dicastery. I'd take Doctrine of the Faith, but you know, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Hey, take what you can get if you get to live in Rome. Jake, next with another weird question for Jimmy. I understand the church teaches that the death penalty is inadmissible. My understanding is that this is because modern society has the means and resources to process dangerous criminals without the death penalty. Correct me if I'm wrong. My question, let's say that a group of humans were surviving on an island cut off from the world and they established a primitive society with their laws to help them survive. In this situation, they wouldn't have the means and resources that modern society has to deal with dangerous criminals. Could they morally administer the death penalty in certain circumstances, or would they have to follow the current teaching of the magisterium? What ethical considerations would they have to take into account if they were to administer the death penalty?
Okay, so the regarding the teaching on inadmissibility, this is something that was introduced in the reign of Pope Francis, and I think that the word inadmissible was chosen. Now, people have commented on it and said it's not part of our tradition to use this word. We don't exactly know what it means, and I think, yes, that's the point. I think Pope Francis had a powerful intuition that the death penalty should not be used, and the word inadmissible was chosen precisely because it's ambiguous. So you can read it as, well, we shouldn't, it clearly means we shouldn't do it. But you can read it in a way that's consistent with previous church teaching that indicated the death penalty was permissible in some situations, but you could also read it as, no, it's never really been permissible at all. That was a misunderstanding in the past. And so I think that it's chosen deliberately to communicate the message, don't do this, but leave it open as to the status of past magisterial teaching. Personally, I'm on the side of we should read it as consistent with past teaching that, you know, there have been situations where the death penalty is morally permissible. And I think that's the case even today, because there is a right of self-defense. You know, if someone breaks into your house, you can use lethal, and is trying to kill you and your family, you can use lethal force to defend yourself. Well, that's the death penalty if you're using lethal force on someone. You can similarly use lethal force in wartime. Now, we don't want wars. We want to do everything we can to avoid wars and to end wars. But if a war starts, you can use lethal force to defend yourself. So I think we need to read the death penalty's inadmissible status in a way that's consistent with those facts, which would mean, in principle, there are situations where the use of lethal force is warranted. So what about this island society where you've got a group of people on an island, they have no contact, I'm going to assume the island is small enough that they can't just separate and say, okay, we've got this person here who's done something worthy of death. Let's say he's killed another fellow castaway. And, you know, let's suppose one of the castaways goes berserk and kills Mr. Howell. for example.
That would be the one. That would be the one to take out if you're going to go berserk. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe over inheritance rights or something.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to assume the island is small enough you can't just exile this guy, because that's the obvious solution. If you got a big enough island, you say, okay, we're voting you out of the group. We can't vote you off the island, but we're voting you out of the group. And so you're going to go have to live by yourself. And that would be a realistic possibility that would need to be considered if the island is big enough. But just to, you know, create a moral crucible to force out the truth, let's suppose the island is not big enough to exile someone. Let's suppose it's a really teeny tiny island. Well, in that case, if there are no other better ways of dealing with the situation, then I would say the use of lethal force to protect future islanders. You know, I'm going to assume this person's not going to stop at Mr. Howell. You know, he's got his sights next on Mrs. Howell. So he can, once he's eliminated the Howells, he can inherit all their money. Well, okay, if he's not going to stop, and this is the use of lethal force is the only practical way to protect society, then I would say the use of lethal force would be warranted the same way if someone breaks into your house and is, which is basically a little island. If someone breaks into your house and is trying to kill you and your family, then you would be warranted in using lethal force to end that threat. And I'd say the same thing would be true on an island rather than a house. Although they did have those grass huts, you know, on Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. You got to protect Lovey, though. I mean, that's what I'm taking from this. All right, Jake. Thank you very much for the question. This one comes from Brooke Kennel 2636. Do criminals with psychopathic disorders have free will? If their free will is compromised by their psychopathy, does that mean that they are not fully accountable, even if their crimes are heinous? Also, what's up with the... Oh, this is a completely different question. Also, what's up with the Holy House of Loretto? Is it legit?
Okay, so let's deal with the second question first. The Holy House of Loretto is a structure that is currently housed in Loretto, Italy, and it's reputed to have been like the home of the Holy Family, and was transported by angels from the Holy Land to Loretto. It appears, at least from the reading I've done, and I have not yet done a deep dive into this, but I may well do a Mysterious World episode on it in the future. It appears, based on the reading that I've done, that there is a basis to this legend, that it is a structure that originally is not from Loretto, and that it was transported to Loretto by the Angeli family. Angeli being an Italian name that means angels. And so this became the basis of the legend that the house was transported by angels. So I don't think that it was transported by angels in the sense of heavenly beings that don't natively have bodies. I think it was transported, at least based on the reading that I've done, by earthly beings that natively do have bodies and happen to be named Angeli. So that's what's up with the Holy House of Loretto, as far as I'm aware. When it comes to criminals with psychopathic disorders, I would say it's going to depend on a few factors. There's a whole scale of psychopathy. It goes from very mild to very extreme. It's measured these days commonly by what's known as the PCLR checklist, which is a measurement of how many psychopathic tendencies does the individual have. And I would say the degree to which free will is compromised is going to depend on the degree of psychopathy. There are going to be people with low psychopathic tendencies who clearly have free will and are clearly responsible. But then people who are maxing out the scale, they may have severely compromised free will. And to the extent their free will is compromised, the same principles are going to apply to them as apply to anybody. To the extent their free will is compromised and they're not acting as rational moral agents, they're not going to be held responsible to that extent. So it can diminish or potentially even remove moral responsibility for heinous actions, the same way any kind of psychological or mental impediment can remove or can diminish or even remove responsibility for what a person does. If you're not a rational moral agent, then you're not going to be held as accountable the way a rational moral agent will.
All right. Every time someone mentions that test, what'd you call it, PCLR test?
The PCLR checklist.
Yeah, I have to go back and take the test again to find out. How many of these to apply? Like,
I'm pretty sure that Cy Kellett would score very low on PCLR.
You can score it yourself, right? You don't need, like, it's not like someone else admits it. You like just look at the things and go.
They want you to be specially trained in how to apply it. Oh, I mean, okay. You can find the questions and ask. Estimate yourself, but in order to have a medical diagnosis, they want, or a psychological diagnosis, they want a trained administrator to administer it to you.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, the last one I note is criminal versatility. And I do feel like I lack virtually every kind of versatility. So I don't think I don't think I have criminal versatility. So I'm pretty.
I'd think I'd score pretty high on that.
Like criminal versatility.
I never use my powers for bad, but if I wanted to, I think I could be pretty versatile.
I thought of a crime one time. I'll tell you about it when we come back. Because someone told me there's a reason why no one commits this crime that I invented. All right, well, let's take a quick break. More weird questions with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit jimmyakinpodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour and next hour. Both hours, Weird Questions. And we got lots of weird questions. I did say that I had invented a crime, so I want to tell Jimmy about my crime and why I was advised that why no one ever committed this crime. This is years ago. Mm-hmm. This is before modern computer tracking chips could be put in things and all that. And I thought, you know, if you're a counterfeiter, don't counterfeit currency, counterfeit chips for a Las Vegas casino. So I wasn't going to do it. I was just thinking this through. And so I told this to a gambler, and he goes, there's a reason why people don't do that, because if the federal government catches you, they put you in jail. But if the casinos catch you, they take you out to the desert and dig a hole. And yeah. I was like, oh, okay. All right. Well, I can see why no one commits that. Well, maybe somebody did commit that. I don't know. But I thought I was so clever with my crime, but I'm not brave enough to.
There would also be a whole bunch of security measures in addition, even back in the day before tracking chips. I don't know that they put RFID chips in casino chips now or not, but even back in the day, there would have been security measures to keep people from smuggling in chips and doing exactly that.
Yeah. Wow.
And digging a hole in the desert would be one of the fail safes.
Right. I've heard there's a lot of holes out there in the desert outside of Las Vegas. So that's my criminal versatility. That's what I came up for the crime of the century. But now kids, don't do this. All right. Don't counterfeit things.
No, don't do this or any other crimes that Cy Kellett recommends.
Right. Exactly. All right. Let's get a question from Daniel for Jimmy. If Adam did not eat the fruit, what would it mean for the fall and the original sin if only one parent ate the fruit?
Yeah, this question comes up periodically, and the answer is we don't know because we're not in that situation. And so if only, we're taking Adam and Eve as literal people who literally ate a fruit, and, you know, there's reason to, you know, question that because the church has acknowledged that early Genesis contains symbolic and figurative imagery, including the fruit. It wasn't really a fruit. That's a symbol that's used to communicate the choice that that our first parents had to make. And since our first parents made the bad choice, we don't know what would have happened if only one of them had done that, or if only some of them had done that. It's possible that if only some had made the bad choice, then only they would have fallen, and the rest of the human race would be left unfallen. It's also possible that if the right people fell, it would have ruined it for everybody. And so this is a model that in Protestant circles is sometimes called federal headship. The idea is that Adam represented the entire federation of mankind. He was the head of mankind. And so when he fell, it basically ruined everything for everybody. And so even if you didn't personally sin, you would be negatively impacted by Adam's sin. And so we don't know what would have happened. We can speculate about it, but the two leading possibilities would seem to be that only some people would be fallen and others wouldn't. It's also possible in that original community, and it's also possible that the whole community would have fallen through some kind of federal headship arrangement. A related question would then be, what happens next after that first generation? Because if you have the reason that we inherit so-called original sin today, which is a deprivation of sanctifying grace, is because our parents are not able to pass on to us the original righteousness that God originally gave the human race. So what happens if you have, let's suppose Eve falls and Adam doesn't. Okay, so they then, as they say in the Incredibles, they then get busy. And what happens with their children? If Adam is unfallen, is he able to pass on that original righteousness, in which case only Eve is fallen and all of their kids turn out fine? Or does Eve's fallenness block Adam's ability to transmit original righteousness so that even though Adam is unfallen, all of their kids end up fallen as well? And the answer is, we don't know. So this is something we can speculate about, but we don't have the answers on this. It's a different set of timelines than we're in.
Daniel, thank you very much for that question. This one comes from Dr. Tafazi. Genetic enhancements on human embryos are clearly immoral because it kills them. But would it be permissible to modify your own germinal tissue, which produces gametes, to not transmit flawed genes to your offspring?
So the first thing I'd have to say is I'm not sure about the initial statement that genetic enhancements on human embryos are clearly immoral because it kills them. It may do that now, but it may not always do that. There may be scenarios in the future where gene therapy has been made safe enough that you could repair genetic damage to people at the embryo stage or later in life. And so if someone was born with a horrible genetic defect, you could apply gene therapy directly to that person, either while they're still an embryo in a safe way, or when they're at a later stage of development, like a child or an adult or something like that. But if something does kill an embryo, well, then obviously that is immoral. You cannot take the life of an innocent person, even if they're an embryo. A person is a person no matter how small. So what about the main question, though, that Dr. Tafazi asks, which is using modifying your own germinal tissue that produces gametes so that your children will not inherit a particular flaw? Well, that's a form of gene therapy that would be totally fine. So, you know, if you have a significant genetic defect that you could pass on to your children, and there's a gene therapy that would stop you from passing that on to your children and allow your children to have normal, healthy genetic codes, then you could absolutely do that. Where the issue of gene therapy gets more dicey is when you're not just repairing damage, but when you're trying to make improvements on the human race, like, oh, I want all my kids to be really tall, or, oh, I want all my kids to be really smart, or, oh, I want all my kids to be really beautiful. Those kind of enhancements are much more problematic. But if you're just repairing damage, so let's say you've got genes that predispose. So, for example, one of the common genetic defects in certain populations, and this includes in sub-Saharan Africa, it also includes parts of Italy, is there is a recessive gene that that can lead to sickle cell anemia. And if you get two copies of this gene, then you get sickle cell anemia, and that's bad. The advantage of the reason that this has evolved, though, is because the same genetic modification that can cause sickle cell anemia also protects you against malaria. And so this genetic mutation tends to be common in areas where there's a lot of malaria, like sub-Saharan Africa and the swampy parts of Italy. You know, Rome used to have terrible malaria problems. And so this evolved as a way of protecting the populations against malaria, but it comes with a cost, which is it also produces sickle cell anemia. Well, today we have ways of dealing with malaria, like let's drain the swamps or let's use various medications. And so malaria isn't the threat that it was even 100 years ago. Used to be just terrible. You know, if you like read Laura Ingalls Wilder books, you know, there's a part where the whole family gets malaria and it's just awful. Well, okay. So today the sickle, at least in many parts of the world, the sickle cell anemia gene is not performing its benefit because we've got other ways of dealing with malaria. And so you could have, if you don't want to have your children have the possibility of getting sickle cell anemia, you could have gene therapy to eliminate that mutation in your gene, in your genetic code, and then you wouldn't pass it on to your offspring, and if and they just have to deal with malaria some other way, which today we have the ability to do.
All right, Dr. Tafazi, I hope that that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the question. This next one comes from Shaggy Cordy, 8228, and it's about ghosts and zombies. And I know a famous Shaggy who frequently deals with ghosts and zombies, so I don't know if it's that one. Do ghosts watch?
I'm sure that Shaggy could answer this question.
Yeah, probably. That's probably right. Do ghosts watch zombies walk around and scream at their bodies for doing dumb things like fall in a manhole or walk into a glass door?
Okay, so in our timeline, ghosts are real, and zombies are also real, but they are not soulless humans. There really are people who are zombies in Haiti, and I did a two-parter on Mysterious World about this. They are individuals who have been involuntarily subjected to chemical manipulation. That specifically, it appears, with, among other chemicals, tetrodotoxin, which is the poison that is produced by pufferfish, which grow in the waters off of Haiti. And so Haitian witch doctors will take tetrodotoxin and other substances and make a poison that will cause a person to appear to die. And then when they revive, they may have suffered brain damage from the poison, or they may be kept in a state where they are controllable by continuing to feed them additional toxic substances. And there are people to whom this has happened who have, like, died twice. You know, we have medical records of, okay, this guy back in the 1960s, he came into the hospital, he died medically, and then now here he is again 20 years later, having just escaped from a zombie plantation. This kind of thing really happens. Wow. And it is documented. But in this case, the person didn't really die. They just appeared to die. So they still have their own soul. There's no separated soul. So what we have, there are separated souls or ghosts, but they're not leaving their bodies behind walking around like zombies. So that's not our reality. But what if we're in a different reality? Like on the American TV show Ghosts. They actually had this situation crop up recently where, so Ghosts is about a young man and a young woman who run a hotel, or the woman gets, or bed and breakfast or whatever, the woman gets knocked on the head, and after she revives, she can see ghosts, including the ghosts that live on their property. Well, one of the ghosts is a guy named Pete. He was a scoutmaster who died when he got shot through the neck with an arrow. And Pete is such a super nice guy. He's just really kind and really positive, and he's just super nice to everybody. Meanwhile, the woman's husband, he's also a nice guy, but he's not quite as nice as Pete. And so on a recent episode of Ghosts, Pete accidentally got into Jay, that's the husband's body, and this was totally by accident, and he ends up in charge of Jay's body. So they do an exorcism to get Pete out of Jay's body. But the problem is the exorcism drives out the evil spirit. And since Jay is not quite as nice as Pete, Jay gets driven out of his own body.
And yeah. So, he's the evil one of
yeah,
the two.
Yeah, he's of the two. And so then later, they do get Pete out of Jay's body. And then you have this zombie Jay walking around with temporary ghost Jay frustrated at it. And if that was something that happened in real life, you know, ghosts have opinions about things too. And if they see their body walking around doing dumb stuff like falling into manholes or crashing through glass doors, I know I would feel, you know, I would feel outraged and frustrated if I saw my body doing that. And so if it was possible in our world to have a person's soulless body still walking around and me as a ghost still witness it, yeah, I'd be frustrated watching it doing dumb stuff. So I think that that would be something that would happen if this was possible, which it does not appear to be in our universe.
Thank you, Scooby. Oh, excuse me. Thank you, Shaggy, for the question. We will take a very quick break. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now, our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Carry the faith wherever you go. You can enjoy EWTN television and radio live streams, many of our popular TV and radio shows on demand, prayers and devotionals, and keep up on the latest Catholic news. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com and join the EWTN family today.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. When you hear that music, you know we're having fun. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live this hour and next hour. And lots of weird questions are in. This one comes from Maxwell. If a priest goes to a bakery and consecrates all the bread, would those bread now become the body and blood of Jesus?
Yeah. So the answer to this one seems to be a straightforward yes. Assuming the bread is otherwise valid matter, which if it is recognized as bread, it presumably would be. Now, if it's made out of some really weird stuff, so it wouldn't qualify as wheat bread, maybe not. Or if it's been doctored up with bunches of other substances, you know, so it's like banana bread or something, well, maybe not. But if it's recognized by ordinary people as wheat bread, even if it's got an admixture of other substances in it, then it's going to be valid matter. And so a priest has the ability to consecrate the bread that's in his moral, that's in his, you know, physical presence, assuming that he has the intention to consecrate it. And this is why priests are taught in seminary that they should form a habitual intention to consecrate all of the bread on the altar in front of them. And so they don't have to every time think about each and every host. It's just my intention is to consecrate all of this bread right here on the altar in front of me. But they're not intending to like consecrate the unconsecrated hosts in stacks back in the sacristy. You know, they're concentrating on the altar. Well, okay, they can do this for bread that's in their presence. So if they change their intention and walk into a bakery and decide, I have the intention to consecrate all of the bread in this bakery and it's in their physical presence, then yeah, that would be what would happen. It would be gravely immoral and gravely illicit for a priest to do this, but it would be physically, metaphysically possible for him to do it.
Maxell, I apologize. I put a W in there where there wasn't one. Thank you very much for the question. Christine wants to know this. Will our resurrected bodies wear clothes?
Well, Jesus apparently did. The New Testament reports him showing up to the disciples and they don't remark on him being naked. So I would assume he was wearing clothes at the time. And, you know, it's not like our bodies are going to suddenly develop an allergy to wearing clothes. So I think it's certainly possible for us to wear clothes in the resurrection. Will we always? Well, maybe not. You know, we use clothes for protection from weather and so forth. And if we're in our resurrected forms, we may not, you know, with the upgrade, the preternatural gifts we'll have, we may not need clothes for protection. And we also wear clothes for modesty and, you know, to help prevent temptation and things like that. But we may not need modesty or be subject to temptation in the resurrection. And so we may not need him for that reason. Also, just for what it's worth, even though early Genesis involves symbolism, Adam and Eve are depicted as not originally needing or wearing clothes.
Oh, yeah.
There's
right.
Something that came after the fall. So if we go back to a pre-fall or better than pre-fall state, we may not need clothes either. And so I would say that that will we wear clothes in the resurrection? Well, if we want to, we will. And on various occasions, we may, just like Jesus, but just like in this life, we may not always need them or wear them.
Christine, thank you for that question.
You ask your question, then I'll bring up a follow-up.
I mean, if we do wear clothes, could we wear like that a disco suit that John Travolta wore in Saturday Night Fever?
If that's what you need in the resurrection to be happy, you can wear your John Travolta disco suit.
Okay, thank you.
Now, what's a related interesting question that Christine doesn't ask about is, what about ghosts who don't have bodies?
Oh, yeah.
Because they frequently appear to people wearing clothes. And actually, if you go on the peer-reviewed Psy Encyclopedia website produced by the Society for Psychical Research in England, they actually have like a 2,000-word article about ghosts and clothing. because they do appear wearing clothes to people, and that's often how they're recognized. They often wear the kind of clothes they wore when they were younger, for example. And the standard interpretation is this is part of a projection. It's a telepathic projection. They ghosts appear to people how they want to appear. So when you have an after-death communication of one of your departed loved ones, they frequently don't look like they did on their deathbed. Instead, they look younger. They're not wearing a hospital gown. They're wearing clothing that they liked, and there are even reports of ghosts who change their appearance to keep up with the fashions. I know about one ghost at a location in California known as the Moss Beach Distillery, who was apparently murdered in like the 1940s or something, and or maybe 30s. I think it was during Prohibition. And she was known as the Lady in Blue because she always was wearing this blue dress from the 1940s. But eventually she started talking to people who witnessed her about modern fashions, and she changed her blue dress into something more modern.
Ah, there's hope. I might be fashionable in the next world, Christine. Thank you very much for the question. This one comes from Jordan. If two people were to swap bodies, a Freaky Friday kind of situation, and if one person were to get in a fatal accident while the bodies were swapped, would both people be considered dead?
Okay, so someone's considered dead if their soul is separated from their body. And so actually, if you think about the Freaky Friday situation, if you have two people, let's call them Jim and Bill, and Jim's soul goes into Bill's body and Bill's soul goes into Jim's body, you could technically consider them both dead right there because their souls are separated from their bodies. But this isn't really what we normally mean by dead. If they're still, you know, they're in a body, it's not theirs, but they're in a body, and it's, you know, living and functioning and having metabolism going on, and it's digesting food, and they're moving around and in control of it. I wouldn't really say Jim and Bill are both dead, even though they're out of their bodies. Mm-hmm. So we'll amend our definition of dead to be you're not in any living body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if that's the case, well, let's suppose Jim in Bill's body goes reckless driving and gets killed, and so Bill's body stops functioning. Well, Jim, he's no longer in Bill's body because Bill's body is dead, and so I would say at this point Jim is dead, but Bill, who is in Jim's body, is still alive, because even though he's not in his own body, he is in a body. It's a living body. It's doing what it's supposed to do. Bill is in control of it. So Bill, who is in Jim's body, I would say is still alive. Now this gets more complicated when we try to put him back in their own bodies. It is possible that Jim could get back in Jim's body and force Bill out of it, at which point Bill would now be the dead one and Jim would be the living one. So I think there are a number of scenarios here, and I'm sure complexify them further depending on how the body swapping works, but there's a sketch of the question as presented.
Jordan, thank you very much for that important question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour and next, and they keep coming. There's no end to the weird questions for Jimmy Akin. And again, I know there's kids listening. Don't swap bodies. Don't do that. Even if you have the opportunity to swap the body with your mother so that you can drive and do whatever you want, don't do that. There are about a million more of these to come. If you really like Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, you should check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's every Friday a new episode drops. There are more than 300 episodes, heading towards 400 episodes now and beyond. And on every kind of mystery and oddity and brain tantalizing, unusual event, you'll find them all there. And Jimmy approaches them using both the perspective of reason and faith to look at them. You can find it at mysterious.fm. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can go to Jimmy Akin's YouTube page, where you can also find his other podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast, where he does Mysteries of the Faith exclusively there at the Jimmy Akin Podcast. We're going to take a very quick break. We will be right back with more weirdness with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.